Thomas Baker was the 9th president of the Rotary Club of Melbourne. He is commemorated by this oration, which showcases Australians who have demonstrated leadership and innovation in the fields of medicine, technology, and industry. Thomas Baker was the entrepreneurial leader of the photographic industry, the founder of what is now the Baker Heart and Diabetes Research Institute, and the humanitarian benefactor who established in his will the Baker Foundation. He was a person of deeds, not words. Professor Fiona Wood AM clearly fits the definition of an Australian who has demonstrated leadership and innovation in medicine and technology. Fiona Wood has been a burn surgeon and researcher for over 20 years and is the director of the Burn Service of Western Australia. She is also the co-founder of the Fiona Wood Foundation, which continues innovative research into burns care, trauma, scar reconstruction, and scarless healing. Please consider support for Fiona's foundation on this postcard that's on your tables. Perhaps Fiona Wood's greatest contribution and enduring legacy is her work pioneering the innovative spray-on skin technique called RECELL, which greatly reduces permanent scarring in burns victims. Professor Wood patented her method in 1993, and today the technique is used worldwide. In October 2002, Fiona was propelled into the media spotlight when survivors from the 2002 Bali bombings arrived at Royal Perth Hospital. She led a team working to save 28 patients suffering from serious body burns, deadly infections, and delayed shock. Fiona was named a member of the Order of Australia in 2003 and Australian of the Year for 2005. We are honoured today that Professor Wood is the 2018 and third Thomas Baker Orator and look forward to her address, Striving for Excellence in Healthcare. Please welcome her to the podium.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today and share some of our experiences over what is now 60 years for me. And as I walked up, I saw the words, be the inspiration. And I feel I'm in like company because I know everyone here is linked with Rotary. And let's face it, an inspirational group. Because over many, many, many years and decades, you have put self behind that of others. It reminds me of the school motto I had is non sibi sed omnibus, not for oneself, but for others. So I feel very comfortable that I'm in the right kind of team today. And for that, I thank you, because I know you will have made differences to lives that you will never see, that you'll never know. And you've done that over your lives by being part of such a group. And so when I think back and I was looking at the life of Thomas Baker, yes, inspirational. He kicked off in Somerset and then landed here, but he was only 11. I was a bit older when I got here. And Somerset, let's face it, it's posh. I came from Yorkshire, which is not. And I started to try to look at what was behind such an individual, and I've come up with a few words that I'd like to share with you. Curiosity. How can somebody do what he did without an extraordinary sense of curiosity? A capacity to work. That four-letter word, work, hard sell to teenage boys, I find, but the work for work's sake, the joy of a job well done. Nobody could have done what he did. Without a capacity to work. Fundamental to our being as humans on this planet, there is no substitute for hard work. And then, Nanaka, my third word is passion. He clearly had a passion for what he found in front of him, such that he could drive forward. And then put in others above self. The Baker Foundation, I know. is an extraordinary, has an extraordinary capacity to change lives, and has done, because of the capacity to facilitate research that will change lives for others. So you put all that together, that curiosity, the capacity to work with passion, and I think, okay, third Thomas Baker oration, here we are. It's hang on. And when Clive kindly I met around the time of the Monash Medal, I thought, oh God, this is overwhelming. It's like really humbling. And again, he asked me to come along today. Again, I feel in part how my personal relationship with Rotary has started so long ago, and it's always been so positive, and has really been part of the inspiration to keep going forward. When you're supported by people, and you share that energy, it gives you that bit of umph to keep going forward. And I first was given I just said this, in the early 90s, in Matilda Bay, by the beautiful Swan River, with a group of people that were instrumental in me getting going, getting started in the early 90s, and actually having the belief that it could be done. That what we had in front of us was actually a journey that was possible. So this, trying to work out what it was that I wanted to share with you today, the whole concept of striving for clinical excellence in healthcare is something that it should be dear to all of us. And then I started, I looked back and I stood back and I thought, what is clinical excellence? How would I define it? And I've been mulling this over and over in my mind over the last few weeks. And I will share with you my definition. Clinical excellence to me is seeing the person I love the most treated when their life's journey has taken a turn for the worst and they've required medical intervention, treated as if the best in the world. And so if you look at that as clinical excellence, it can't be anything less than that. So we want the very, very best treatment in the world. There are two ways of seeking that, buying in, or driving from the front. Driving to actually innovate, driving to see what the solutions to the problems are, how to make them real in our environment. And it comes back to then, we're in this together. And again, I've just briefly said at the table that I think, you know, we need a society dependent upon the integrity of each and every one of us, not the intellect of a few. And so when we're looking at clinical excellence, it starts right from the beginning. It starts with education, early childhood. It starts with understanding that we have, every one of us is unique. Everyone's got a gift to give, and we have to facilitate that gift in each other. Looking at our wellness and our health, investing in our future, and then, of course, making sure we look after all of those around us. And so with that lofty ideal, how do we make it real? And in 2005, my life changed in a way I would have never been able to predict. You know, as I look back down the tunnel of time, coming, as I say, from being a coal miner's daughter in Yorkshire, marrying a West Aussie, and he said to me, it's non-negotiable, you marry me, we live in Perth and it's not Scotland. I'd known him 3 weeks. Perfectly reasonable decision. 10 weeks later, the deed was done, and then 2 years later, here I was. I was in WA. That morning, wake up. He said, what's the matter? It was November 87. And I said, it's sunny. We can't miss a sunny day. He goes, there'll be plenty more of them. I thought, oh, where have I come? And so, and that, as I say, in 2005, I still find it hard to sort of put that year in a bubble, really, because it was so extraordinary. But I was asked questions that really are very important to the discussion today. I was asked what I want, you know, I was asked a couple of questions. The funniest was I Australian? And in my best Yorkshire accent, just as we were walking up the stairs to get the glass trophy that Mr. Nobody smashed in my house from John Howard, I said, no, does it matter, lad? And I just thought, this could be really embarrassing. I could be doing a resuscitation on the in front of Parliament House. No, I'm just kidding. Bad joke, bad timing. But the serious question was, what is it that I'd like to share with the people of Australia? What is the message? And again, I'd never done anything like that before. I'd never thought, wow, you know, what an opportunity. And my message was, really, that we're in this together. That we have to understand that the decisions we make as individuals have an enormous ramification on our whole society and our community. And that we had to take responsibility for those decisions in terms of our health, our wellness, and our education, such that we would see a society that had the resources to drive medical research right at that front of that point and spearhead it. Spearhead it like we've seen, like the cochlear implant and many other examples. And so that's where what the sort of message was, and it remains so. And so I'd like to share with you a few stories of how people have inspired me and motivated me to continue on the journey that we have, and a journey that I think is increasingly exciting and increasingly complex, and therefore this collaboration and community becomes increasingly important. As a young registrar in 1990 in Western Australia, I met a 56-year-old lady who had a 70% body surface area burn. That means her head, this about this much of the top quarter, was not burnt. I was watching and her life fading away as the waves of infection came over, and she felt like she was falling through our fingers like sand. And I heard on the radio, as I was driving to the Royal Perth Hospital, that Joanne Padlanetsky, a scientist in Monash, and Professor John Masterton, who ran the burn service here in Victoria, had gone to Boston and had brought back the technology to grow skin cell sheets. And to be able to grow those skin cell sheets means that you can take a small piece of skin from someone that's not injured, the area that isn't injured, take it to the laboratory and grow those cells into multiple sheets such that you can, it's tissue-based, it's tissue expansion in the laboratory. I was overwhelmed with the fact that we could do this. We could do this for this lady. We could actually send, there was long, one piece of skin on the inner upper right arm that wasn't harvested. We could send that skin to Melbourne. They could grow it in Melbourne and they could send it back to us. I still marvel at how many people said no to me and then I didn't hear it until they said yes. And I said, so I went to the consultant in charge of the case, the consultant in charge of intensive care, Bill Beresford was in the medical administrator in charge of the hospital, and said Airways could have been the straw that broke the camel's back, because they did it all for nothing for us. And they sent that, the last piece of skin was couriered to Melbourne. And then Prof and John said, whoa, this doesn't sound, we've never grown skin from someone that's been so ill for so long. But they said to me later on, when I got to know them very well, that I sounded so desperate. They did say yes, but they said it quietly and then said yes. So no, very quietly, because they realised that I wouldn't hear it until they said yes. And so the skin went with ANSET, and ANSET very kindly funded Prof and Joanne to come back to Perth 3 weeks later. We had enough skin in the flasks, in the tissue culture flasks, which are all about the size of a standard old-fashioned iPhone, to cover the whole of the areas. She was healed. She got out of intensive care, and she was on the burns unit when she had a cardiac arrest on a Wednesday afternoon, from which we could not resuscitate her. And I learned so much that day, in that hours, in those minutes. As a young doctor, I was the one at the resuscitation, and I was the one that would go and speak to the family. I had called in so many favours. I had nagged for Great Britain and Australia combined. I had just not listened to no. I couldn't believe that we could not do this. This was the best that you could do in the world at that time. And so I'm thinking that I'm feeling pretty crushed. And I looked down the corridor and I saw my next stop was to speak to the family. And it was like hit me straight between the eyes, however bad I feel, however compromised I feel, it is nothing compared to those who've loved her. Absolutely nothing. And took a deep breath and thought, whoa, what can I do? How can I get up tomorrow? How can I actually come back and do this? Because this is actually a bit hard. And I realized that one thing that I could offer in that conversation with the family was that what I'd learned would save the lives of others. That's all I could put on the table. That was the only thing I could give them, that kernel, that seed of hope. And so going fast forward, I met Marie Stoner in the bone marrow laboratory when we were preparing the skin for this lady. By 1993, we had our own skin lab in Perth with Marie and myself, funded by Telethon, funded by our community. We then realized very rapidly, with very close observation, that 3 weeks to grow the skin was too long for me. If a wound takes 10 days to heal, your chances of scarring are 4%. It gets to 70%+ by 3 weeks. We had to move fast. The one thing about this, I'd pulled in all these favors, I'd done the very best in the world could do at that point in time, I'd just done it 5 months too late. Time to healing became an obsession, and it still is. Every day in a burns unit is painful. If you can reduce it by a day, you've done a better, you know, that's good. 2 days is better, and so on. And so our first cab off the rank, we took 10 days to grow the sheets. We looked at what everybody did in the world that was fast, and we added a few of our own sort of ideas. But by 1994, we realized that if we put the cells on as a suspension, that they were actually much more active across the wound surface and they healed quicker. We did a lot of experiments at the time working all this out. And one day I walked out of the operating room, and we operate at 34 degrees in a major burn because you lose your capacity to maintain your temperature. And if your core temperature falls, then you don't clot your blood, and that's kind of bad for business, because it ends up on the outside rather than staying on the inside. And so we jack up the environmental temperature, so the deal is if you're not sweating, you're not working hard enough when you're doing a burn. And that's, you know, just toughen up. Yeah, this is what we do. And so I came out of the operating room into the air-conditioned laboratory with beautiful Marie sitting there, and we're not sure which one of us said it, but we should just spray this stuff on. And then the lab was dust. It was empty. Because we'd gone down to Rockaby Road, into the Jackson's Art Store, into the pharmacy, upstairs to the anaesthetic trolley, anything that sprayed, hairspray, nose spray, throat spray. And we found an Italian mouth freshener. And when we took the nozzle off that Italian mouth freshener and put it on a 5 mL syringe, 90% of the cells coming through the system were viable and functional. And that's still the nozzle we use. We did have a lot of mouth freshener in the corner of the lab for a very long time, until Remo Papini, our first fellow in 1996, came along, and I said, with a name like that, please, you must be able to speak Italian. Just get onto them and tell them we just need the nozzles, because they just couldn't understand what we were saying. And so we were able to then see that an experiment further, and we saw that our major burns, scarring, where we were really going rapidly, closing them down rapidly, now we'd gotten down to only 5 days in the laboratory, then, well, what would happen if we actually put the skin cells straight away after the harvest, straight away onto the body, use the body as the tissue culture flask? That had to adjust our surgical approach, a whole raft of other things, but then we made a kit. And Marie and I took a drawing of what we kind of got a McDonald's burger box and kind of said, well, this is the kind of thing we want, and we kind of cut and pasted it all. And so we had electronics to warm up the enzyme, and the enzyme had to be specifically made, and we had cell filters and all these different things in this McDonald's box in our pictures. And we went and knocked on the door of somebody in near the airport in Perth who did molding, plastic molding, and he said, "Oh, love, I do big stuff. You need this, the guy down the road." And that is still the dye that is used for the kit now in California, in Ventrex. How a scientist and a junior surgeon could figure this out, I still can't remember. Yeah, I look at it now and I use it every day in surgery, and I think, well, how did we do that? But we did it by asking and connecting with people. One of our obstetricians is a great innovator, and he has a company called Go Medical. And so we went there, and they worked out how to heat the put the coil around the glass vial to heat the enzyme. We went to CSL. They make enzymes, don't they? Knocked on the CSL door, and they made a specific enzyme. They still do for the kit. So we couldn't do it alone, is that my assertion. We had to do it collectively and with everyone around us. And I learned again, reaffirmed my experiences as a medical student, that if you ask somebody and they say no, and have not, don't follow it up with a potential solution, walk on by. Because criticism without engagement in problem solving is a black hole. It can suck your energy out, and there's no point going there. But criticism, engagement in problem solving, that's where you go. And so we were able to solve that problem, and that went off to be the kit that is marketed around the world. And it sort of gave us an opportunity to connect, and connect much more broadly than we would have otherwise. And it really made me understand that if we're striving for clinical excellence, we have to go interdisciplinary. We have to go beyond the traditional medical, nursing, allied health model. We have to understand that we need to talk to our whole of our community. And so if I go further forward and in time, and there are two things, stories I'd like to share with you. One is in a young boy I met in 2003. In 2003, he suffered an 80% body surface area burn on a farming accident. We did what was the best in the world at that time for his repair. We thought we'd done a fantastic job, but we found some 18 months later that the tightness of his scar across his abdomen wasn't because of the scar, but it was because of the tumor in his liver underlying it. He died as an 11-year-old from a rare tumor, which was already in his bone when he presented with it that 18 months after the burn injury. I spent my life working out on time to healing, reducing the impact of burn injury, reducing the stress, reducing the risks of infection, trying the best we can to actually return someone to what their life was before. And in certain circumstances, one of our PhDs that's just been completed was in post-traumatic growth. How do people take on such human suffering and come back stronger? Now, if we knew that and we could bottle it, my goodness, we could be really in business then, couldn't we? But there it is, again, fail, this ultimate failure. And so, N is one. Is it a coincidence? Is it something that you just say it's bad luck and you walk on by? All I could offer his parents is that I'll never forget that. And in Western Australia, we are very strong in data linkage. And by 2009, with courtesy of me, my reigniting my capacity to nag, we had an NHMRC grant which linked all the databases in Western Australia. And I can tell you, from 34,000 patients requiring hospitalisation for a burn injury, matched with 120,000 patients' age, sex, geospatial and socioeconomic equivalents, 1 to 4, if you survive a burn injury, you have an increased risk of cancer, you have an increased risk of heart disease across the board and death from it, increased risk of infection, mental illness, neurological diagnoses. We've published over 30 papers in this area. But how? Why? What is going on? And again, we've on the quest of collaboration and connecting with our cardiology colleagues around the inflammatory side of what goes on in that space, understanding the the stress of the burn and trying to understand at the cellular level whether that changes the capacity of the cells of that person to survive. Looking at all of the body, because these are things that happen remote from the burn. And during that whole journey, we've connected with IBM Watson drug discovery, big data, machine learning. If IBM built a computer that could win a game show, I figured they could maybe help me. And so their team came over from New York to Perth just before last Christmas. And we basically, it's got the whole of the world's literature, and it's read it, this machine, more than I can. Patents included, pharmaceutical data, a whole raft of things. And being taught how to interrogate it wasn't an insignificant task. But then we were able to hone in and find out what pathways at the cellular level, what gene expressions were maybe, just maybe, the culprits. And now with IBM support and Woodside support and a whole lot of other people, we're starting to investigate in animal models, in our clinical circumstance, what is it that changes around that acute burn that changes your life ever? Because by understanding that, we can change that life forever. 1 year ago, 5-year-old came in, burnt from his chin to his knees to his elbows down to muscle, 50% of his surface. I sat with all the team teaching them how to repair this burn wound, and in 6 weeks he was fully healed. It's the best we could do in the world today. And everybody was very happy, yet I, 1 year ago, why am I the one that's sobbing into my handkerchief? I did that operation in 2003. I did that same operation in 1997. We've got to be able to do better tomorrow. So in the last year, I've been putting together a team that will not only facilitate, as we've done before, spraying cells onto the wound, but actually bioprinting at the bedside, three-dimensional skin construct. And if we can crack that, as I've told the team, if we could crack that on the surface, then you can miniaturize it and you can go internal and maybe you can inject directly into the heart in areas of damage. And that's very futuristic. But the future starts here. The future starts here with dreaming. And I think it's really important that we're only limited by our imagination and that our curiosity, and that we back it up with passion and a capacity for hard work. Because really, there's no substitute. And let's remember, we're all in this together. And together, we can change the life of an individual. And because I'm the world's greatest optimist, we can change the world. Thank you very much.